Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 143, with guests from Cine Mayward, Joel Mayward. Also joining us is Jason Potnick from Rindaria.com. So listen up, because we've got a really immersive show for you. On this episode, we talk Dunkirk and theater as religious experience.
I do feel funny. So I don't know if I've talked about this, but I am a pacifist, I hold to that. It's just after years of theological thinking and reading scripture and coming to that conclusion. But my son Copeland is super fascinated with war and World War II stuff. He's been watching these documentaries on Netflix about World War II and really interested in bombers and things blowing up. And so when I told him about Dunkirk, he was excited about it. And there's no way I'm going to let my 8-year-old watch that. He can't even handle Finding Nemo yet, because he's pretty sensitive. And so the idea of watching Dunkirk, I think he would literally explode or something like that. It would be traumatic. But when I was talking to him about it, the battleships and the airplanes, they're these Spitfire planes and all that entails, he was just fascinated by the whole thing in a way that kind of made me unsettled because of that pacifist mindset that I have. And and so watching my son grow up not liking movies, really, for one, and then also being really interested in war, this movie loving pacifist is a little worried about the kind of where's that coming from, and what kind of influence am I having if he's going the opposite route. But I think he'll be okay. Yeah. He's too kind to be a warmonger.
So, Joel, I definitely hear what you're saying about, your son really being, one, opposite of you, but, specifically being into war films and war history and stuff like that. I would say this, if it helps. I probably stated this on the podcast before, but you being in the pacifist camp probably puts you in good company with a lot of people at Real World Theology. Not all of them, definitely not all of them, but there are a small pocket of us, which I think is an unequal representation of Christianity as a whole, especially American Christianity. But, when I was young, heck, still now, if there's a war movie out, almost any war movie I will go see. I love watching war movies. I love, I love war history. I was a history major in college, and I found myself on that path because I enjoyed war history. When I was in middle school and high school, I remember I used to, instead of going to my room to go to sleep, I would stay in our living room at my house, and I would just watch the History Channel until I fell asleep, watching documentaries on battleships and bombers and, specific battles of specific wars. And I just was fascinated by it. And now, again, I'm still fascinated by it. I love reading about it. I love learning about the events of those wars and the history and the implications, what led to it, what came out of it. And I think it was studying it for so long that and the maturation of my own faith and theology that I am now in the basically the pacifist camp. For some reason, it still hasn't made me stop being interested in that stuff. But I realize that for me personally, I don't want to be a part of any of that. So where kids are in their young age isn't necessarily where they will end up.
So absolutely. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And I actually think of when I was a kid, my dad was in the military and I was interested in military things too. And I read lots of books about guns, and I am a pretty good shot with a gun, and debated what that would look like to join the military when I was in middle school and had all these kind of, you know, fantasies or ideas about what that would mean, and watched movies, war movies, and then things like Red Dawn, like the original one with the Wolverines and mm-hmm. Patrick Swayze. And with those kind of things forming my adolescent imagination, I had all these different ideas of what that entailed. And then becoming an adult and reading more of scripture and seeing the effect of war and Jesus and some of the ideas that he proposes, particularly in the Sermon on the Mount, I started to realize more and more that those fantasies back then were just that. They were fantasies, the idea of glory and the goodness that could come out of a person killing another human being, typically for some sort of national ideology or political means or colonialism or all those other kinds of things. So,
or at least what you see most of the time glorified in stories told about war.
Mm-hmm. And yet, no, I'm with you. Like, the one of my favorite films, which I know that you will critique because it's Terrence Malick, is The Thin Red Line. And that was the film that really opened my eyes to the beauty of cinema and really is a significant part of my cinephile story, because it was a movie about war, but it was very different than Saving Private Ryan or similar war films that didn't necessarily glorify war, but were more straightforward in their depiction of the, you know, action and the horror of war and the guns and explosions and things like that. And Malick's film is just much quieter and more contemplative and poetic even, and some would say boring. And I think
who would say that?
That nobody I know. But with that, I know that that opened my eyes to a different. It shaped my imagination both in terms of what I liked about film and in terms of what I didn't like about war. It helped me, I suppose, in that journey or that process of towards pacifism. I suppose I could actually cite that film as an influence.
Well, I think that's fair.
Yeah, what I was going to jump in on too is just on the idea of raising kids. And you know, I've got two that are a little bit older than your oldest, and it was about that 8-year-old time it seemed like they really started to become who, you know, a autonomous person. You know, it just they're their own person at that point, and it's been this interesting learning how to guide them because I can't force them to be what I want to be. And I say, as someone on the, you know, in the pacifism side, I'm still sort of in process there. I have a hard time reconciling the way Christians talk about war. And so, you know, but at the same time, I don't know. I have not spent enough time theologically trying to figure out what I really think about it. I've started studying just war theory and things like that to try and figure out what it is I would really believe about this. But I like what Mikey says, is like, I don't want to be a part of it. I have no desire to be a part of war. But you know, I also recognize this a large history of Christianity where there's this idea of, is there the possibility of bringing justice through it? And that's kind of where I've been wrestling with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really, I feel like almost at some point we're just going to have an episode where we have like a round table about just war theory. And then, you know, it's specifically its portrayal in film. Because like I said, it does swing both ways. And I think, there's a lot, you know, it's another one of those topics where there's a lot of very smart, well thought out, you know, theological giants who think just war is a thing. And then on the other side, there's same adjectives who have come to the conclusion that it is a myth. And I think there's probably room for everyone, but all I can say now is, like many other things that I don't think are black and white, even though I think it's probably more black and white than a lot of other people do, I can choose not to participate in it. Like, I can use it. I can state it as a personal conviction, instead of a rule, you know, like mm-hmm. a handed down rule. And like I said, I would love for it to be a handed down rule. And I think there might be some arguments there to make, but in this particular case, I'm trying not to disparage anyone who does not agree with me on it. Because like I said, I realize you can make a lot of good cases for both. And I think it's really interesting. Something that, there's something there that's inherent in humanity. And I'm not sure if it's good or bad, or maybe it's one of those things where it can be both, because I have a number of friends who are like, you know, I won't let my kids play with guns because I don't want them to teach them violence, or I won't let them play this video game because I don't want them to grow up being violent and things like that. And, you know, I think we could probably all look to ourselves and be like, well, we did all these things and we came to a different conclusion, or, you know, we focused on different things when we got older. I know I had I had so many toy guns. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, I was way into war stuff, history, all that stuff, military history. And yet that's not how I am now. So I don't think necessarily one leads to another, but I'm curious. I think even if you try to cut it out, it might be because it's a cultural saturation. But I had one of our mom friends was kind of lamenting the fact that she said, every time someone gives my kids like a Nerf gun or some kind of toy gun, I always take it away. I don't let them have it, to the point where they basically never even see it. But I found that even though I do that, I will walk into the kitchen and find that like my kids have kind of chewed their pieces of pizza into guns, and they're chasing each other around with like pizza guns, playing shoot at each other. So I feel like there's got to be something there inherent in humanity that tilts towards violence, and I don't like it, but I can see how in certain cases it could be helpful if used right. Aggression. Yeah, it's like anything else. I think it's one of the more dicey ones, like anger, you know, like you can see Jesus being angry and you're like, well, that's the one time we can be angry. Anger in almost every other sense is not right. It's not righteous. And it's really hard to argue, I think, one way or the other. And it being like a blanket rule instead of situational. So,
yeah, I think the reason I get so from the Christian side of it, you know, as a Christian, as a leader in the church, whenever we have to keep making up rules or thoughts about it, it seems like to me we're not separating ourselves anymore and just being that difference to the world. And so that's mm-hmm. where I start to fall on the pacifist side of things is, if the world is all doing it, aren't we supposed to be a different voice, mm-hmm. you know, that voice of love to the world? And so then how can we participate in it? Because we're participating in something that really is more world than I think, you know, I don't think that there's war in heaven, right? Like yeah. So this idea that it's Christian is what I struggle with the most.
Yeah, that's always tough. When someone says, well, they're doing it, so why can't we just do it too? That's the only thing they understand. I'm like, well, the Bible tells us there's something better than that. But again, like I said, that starts down a path of arguing about something that people have been arguing about for quite some time.
True.
And to kind of rein us in a little bit, I think what I love about how this conversation started is, Joel, you're talking about, you know, your son really being into like war history and war-esque things, yet you wouldn't let him see Dunkirk. While I would say I've read more than one review that have talked about how maybe they didn't argue specifically that this is an anti-war film, but that the things that this film glorifies, the things that Dunkirk or Nolan glorifies through Dunkirk, are not the things that you typically see. Like this shows how cowardice isn't necessarily, doesn't make someone a coward. Like being afraid doesn't necessarily make someone less of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
So it's showing us something different. And you're still hesitant to show your son.
Yeah, I think I'm hesitant partly because of the nature of what this film is, how immersive it is, mm-hmm. and the form that it takes, the whole IMAX and 70 millimeter thing, and how intense of a movie it was for me. And I know for a lot of people that they come out of it shaken or quite moved, or, you know, kind of feel throttled a bit because of how intense of a film it is. And the score is just pounding, and, you know, there's bomb, the first gunshot that went off, when they're in the opening sequence, walking through the town, just was like an explosion in the theater that I was in. And I watched it in 70 millimeter, and it shook me. You know, I jumped, and the rest of the film, I was a bit on edge because of that. And knowing my son, this is the thing, he's fascinated with war and the idea of war in a kind of a conceptual way, and the historical side of things, and even the technical things, like how they build submarines and how they make airplanes and mm-hmm. how far they can go and how fast they can go. But when it comes to the loss of human life, my son is one of the kindest people I've ever met. And he doesn't necessarily get that from me. My wife and I talk about this. Like, we learn so much from him because of his kindness towards his brother and sister and towards other people, and his generosity that just kind of comes from somewhere inside of him. And so it does feel a little bit like a disconnect when he's so fascinated with war and yet is so gentle and warm and friendly towards other people. And so coming all the way full circle to Dunkirk, I don't know that it's necessarily an anti-war film in that, like a film like Paths of Glory makes it very, very clear, you know, war is bad and there's injustice that comes from it, and it shows the depravity of it, and it ends on a pretty sad note, where Dunkirk is not, it shows the horrors of war and how scary and frightening and traumatizing this is, but there's also a glorious side to it, and even an emotionally moving side to it, that I think it does depict very well. And so I can't say for, you know, this whole, just make a wholesale statement that it's an anti-war film, but I can't also say that it's a pro-war film.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be one of those, it just depicts war as it is. Maybe not necessarily the most realistic, but it felt realistic to me, like akin to a Saving Private Ryan opening sequence on the beach kind of moment,
mm-hmm.
In terms of its intensity and authenticity to the location and even the kind of boats and the kind of planes and what they're wearing, all those kinds of things. So I'd be curious if you, in your history major background, if you would have anything on that, like to speak to the historical side of this, or whether this is a historically accurate depiction of what happened that day or that week, or if it's something that's a bit more, you know, kind of cinematic and fantasy like.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things to me trying to read up about it and seeing what complaints, because, you know, as soon as any kind of historical movie that comes out, you have the people that were like, actually, did you know?
Yep.
hopefully to never be that kind of history person. But, you know, I think in anything that you make like this, you're going to focus on people who probably, you know, didn't specifically exist, which is fine. I'm completely fine with fictionalized history. As long as the point isn't the person, the point is the thing that the person's involved in,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is to use the word point more than I have already, is kind of, it seems like the point of the film. And by that degree, I think the story, this thing, this event in history that was basically tailor-made for a movie to be made about it, because movies have been made about it. it was done very well. Like you felt and saw things that you would have felt and seen if you were there. And most of the only things that I've seen and read that have really kind of criticized anything that this movie does is like the exclusion of either Indian soldiers or African American soldiers.
Whole whitewashing thing.
Yeah, kind of the whitewashing. And I mean, I don't want to like super defend that, because there definitely were a lot of, and when I say Indian soldiers, I mean like the country of India, mm-hmm. because at the time, like, this is when a lot of the British Army was consisted a lot of people from various nations because of their imperialism. So there would have been more than was shown in the movie, because there were zero shown in the movie that anyone has pointed out. But it was still, compared to the 400,000 soldiers that were there, it was still fractional. So it's possible to tell the story without that. Probably would have been a little more accurate to at least give them some kind of mention, or like have a regiment of them somewhere from their particular battalion or something like that. But yeah, other than that, historically, like I said, it was great. It's almost everything you could have wanted. It is like the beach scene in Saving Private Ryan. Like, this is like more what it was like than anything you could have seen made in the 40s or 50s, where it's, you know, potted plants and people walking by and gunfire and people falling down. Like, this is an immersive experience, and that's great. And it's that immersive experience that I'm kind of hoping to take us on a slight tangent about, because I think I'm very curious, and I think it deserves to be talked about to some degree. And I think Dunkirk is a great movie to do this for, because of the experience of Dunkirk and because of who made Dunkirk and his comments about it. And that's it seems very hard to argue that Christopher Nolan makes movies to be seen in as big a theater with as large a speakers as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it in probably like the best option that I had anywhere reasonably close. We have a LIMAX theater, which claims to be IMAX, but is definitely not. And was very loud. And anyone who asked me if they should see the film, whether I liked the film or not, I said, well, if you go, I know people are saying this, but you should probably see it in the biggest and loudest theater that you can, because I think that's why this film was made. But Christopher Nolan is also the person who recently went on a rant about how basically, and I'm blanket statement, he was basically talking about how Netflix was basically destroying cinema. Because Netflix doesn't release things in theater. And when we have a movie like Dunkirk, I probably would be I would have little interest in seeing Dunkirk on my TV screen at home. And so much so that I don't think it would have the same effect. So,
oh, totally.
So, Jason, just because I haven't heard from you in a while, because I've been talking for a long time, like, do you feel that Netflix is ruining the cinema? Or do you think that, do you think that Netflix should change how it does things?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's ruining cinema. I did read part of that Nolan discussion, and obviously it was he went into it because someone asked him, hey, why don't you make movies for Netflix?
Well, yeah.
He's like the most technical director out there right now, who designs every inch and every sound to be put in a giant movie theater that's going to blow you away. So I could see why he wouldn't want to do movies with Netflix. I think that, I think what Netflix does some amazing things right. I mean, I love it. We watch and I love what Netflix is able to do for smaller television style media, right? Like, the gamut of their TV shows, in which they're learning the right number of episodes, where length doesn't matter of any one particular episode, like, oh, that's awesome. But So it makes some really great TV, and we're just, I think we're seeing a huge influx of that. That has caused Amazon and HBO and everyone to continue to compete, you know, and we're just better for it as people who love to take entertainment. But I think the movie theater experience is something that a lot of, like you said, I don't see how Dunkirk works on the TV. It's a movie I really enjoy. It's probably a movie I will eventually own, but it's a movie I'm always going to want to watch on the biggest screen in the loudest room I can find, because that's what it's designed for. I saw it twice, 35 millimeter on a normal screen. And then I did last night go and find our 70 millimeter IMAX, cause I figured I should be prepared for tonight. and it blows you away. It just felt like it's all with purpose, right? It's definitely something Nolan wants you to hear all this noise. I saw some things where he talked about there are times that you can't understand what people are saying, and that's actually on purpose. Like, he's designed it that way to say the noise of where you're at, just the general cacophony of everything around you, is supposed to drown out a person trying to talk, even if they're right next to you. And if I were in my theater at home, or, you know, watching TV at home, I could adjust settings to listen to the voices and not hear the noise. And then the movie won't have nearly the same effect as it does, you know, hearing it in that space. Also, I found it was kind of neat because it's a gripping experience. It was very difficult for me to watch. I mean, very few movies I'm clenching my seat or wringing my hands during, but this is a movie that does that with the way it changes scenes and the ticking and the constant threat of death around. I felt that a lot of the movie, but a couple times, especially the second time, I kind of glanced around, and it was interesting to see other people going through that, you know, people I don't even know, but that's part of the reason I love the movie experience as well, is it's a shared experience with people, even though they're people you may not even know or ever see again. There's a community thing there as well, I think.
So, yep. Joel, do you think Netflix should change what it does? Should it release their movies in theaters?
Well, picking up on what Jason was saying, I think that communal experience of going to the theater is significant. And even I've talked about it before as being religious or even liturgical, like the practice of going to a theater, being in this space with other people, devoting your attention to this story that's unfolding before you, that's more than just a story, that's an experience that you're partaking in. There is something that's transcendent about that, or can be, if viewed that way and with the right film. And with Dunkirk, I agree. Like, if I'm watching that on my phone or my laptop, you know, like, that's not the same experience, because it was never intended to be that way. So the question of whether Netflix is changing or affecting the way that we view film and the cinematic experience, I think it is changing things, some things for the better and some things for worse. I'll be honest, out of all the Netflix movies I've seen, I don't think I've ever considered putting them on like my end of year top 10 list. Like, they're fine. And some of them are pretty good. Beasts of No Nation with Idris Elba, when that came out, I think that was their first full movie that they did, I was pretty impressed with. And some of the documentaries that they put out are impressive too. But I do think their strength is more television than film at this point. I've been more impressed with the TV shows that I've watched. But they also are cranking out a lot of stuff, and not all of it's great. And I do wonder, I've read recently that they're like $20 billion in debt. I just wonder if there's going to be some sort of tipping point where the bubble bursts and Netflix just goes down. But I do think that streaming into people's homes has changed what that theatrical experience is like, as well as that if you raise prices on theaters, there's an economic factor here too, right? So if I'm going to go see a 70 millimeter film in IMAX and the cost is $18 or $20 or something like that, or I'm paying $10.99 a month to stream Netflix and I can watch any number of movies, you know, from the comfort of my own home, And I don't have to be around all those annoying other people who are texting on their phones during the theater or crunching Amen. On popcorn next to me or kicking the seat behind me or something like that or weird smells. I definitely had like somebody just chowing down on a couple of hot dogs right next to me before and was like, this is, I'm just watching this movie with this hot doggy smell. And all I can think of is, you know, like a baseball stadium or a sports event or something like that. And just kind of being like, this is kind of weird and distracting. But the good side of watching Dunkirk in a packed theater with people, like what Jason was saying, there's others that are going through that with you. And there is something communal about it, even if it's unspoken. Like I shared that experience with those people in that theater in downtown Portland. And we went through something together. And I think that there is something important to say about that, that places of communal gathering to celebrate art in our culture of individuality and isolation need to be maintained and celebrated. So I think there's something good about the theatrical experience that Netflix simply can't do without releasing its movies into theaters.
I'm thinking about, or I'm getting this mental picture of when you're talking about theaters as almost liturgical experiences, like very religious experiences. And we even say, you know, like movie theaters are modern day pulpits. Like it's a place where people come and they're learning something. And it's very, very easy to equate them to houses of worship because of the reasons people go and how they get there. But I think unlike churches, the reason that it's easy for Netflix to rise to the occasion is because if I'm watching someone or if I'm watching a movie or a TV show on Netflix, and I'm even if I'm watching it with people, I am typically in charge of who those people are. And so I can make sure that the religious experience that I'm having is one that kind of is tailor-made or is at least acceptable to my sensibilities. Whereas if we take this and kind of analogy and take it to its conclusion, then what I'm picturing is the idea of us going to experience this religious thing at a theater in community is the equivalent of trying to be comfortable worshiping with like a Baptist and a Pentecostal and an Anglican and a Catholic and an Eastern Orthodox all in the same theater. And all of them are basically getting on each other's nerves being like, we're here because we know this is going to be great, but we can't stand the people around us because they're doing it wrong. Because I'm sure that the hot dog people are like, why is this schmo over here not eating hot dogs? You can't watch a movie without scarfing down a couple dogs.
Or the texting thing. I feel bad when I've asked people to put their phones away. And I'm like, why do I feel bad? They're the ones being jerks. But then they treat me like I'm the one being a jerk to even dare ask them to do that. Like, who am I to encroach on their freedom to check their phone in the middle of a movie? But so it's distracting to both. And there is that tension there. And it is petty. But I think you're hitting on something that to connect it to the church idea of, what are the things that unite us? What are the things that divide us? What are the things that we, we should hold fast to? And what are the things that maybe we can be a bit more open-handed and humble about when it comes to the quote-unquote right way to do this?
Yeah.
Texting is still bad.
But let me just say, this is a sin. Not
happen. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so what you're doing is the every time you ask a person to stop texting, it's basically like showing up and asking the Pentecostal to put their flag away. And
yeah.
And you're like, I get it. This is what you do during a religious experience, but this is a no flag zone. I'm going to need you to sit down and watch the movie and stop spinning around.
I'm like a Quaker, the worshiping in silence. And you just focus on that for 2 hours. And then we all leave and we're good. We can talk about it afterwards.
That's right.
Great, but don't text at all or talk to me in the middle of it.
Well, so it's one of those things where outside of Dunkirk, and what, like Gravity. I think there are rarely films that are made that are completely different experiences. I mean, like, it might be more fun, or it might be more interesting or cooler, or, you know, something that is incrementally better. But there are very few movies I feel like are made that if you miss them in the theater, you have missed the experience.
Yeah.
And because of that, because I apparently don't want to go to my house of worship with people who annoy me when I'm trying to worship the story that I'm watching, I would rather pay greater money to just watch it at home. I would rather invite, like, you know, 4 to 6 of my friends over and pay like $50 and just stream a brand new release and watch the next Marvel movie from my couch. Then have to go and have people texting or anything like that. Because I feel like this experience, theatrical immersive experiences aren't something that I find is a thing that happens very often. Am I wrong on that? Like, are you guys seeing way more films that, Jason, are you seeing more films that are drastically different if you don't see them in the theater?
Honestly, no. I would say for me, though, what I've found is that experience of getting out of my house and going to a movie, whether it's when I take my kids to, or when I go with friends to, or when I just go to by myself, because I've been doing that a lot lately. I enjoy the movie better that way. And I don't know if that's just me now or what, but if I say, oh, is the latest Marvel movie different on the big screen than it is at home? Not really. I think, and again, I'm biased because Arrival's my number one movie last year. I think Arrival, just because of, again, the way it was shot, seeing it on the big screen made a difference. Anything where there's some really amazing cinematography, just having the bigger screen to see it on. Revenant is kind of one that comes to mind too, like that, where you just, you know that something special was done with the camera. And to see it in all of its, you know, glory on the big screen, like, it is a different experience than trying to rewatch it at home. But I think you're right. There are a lot of movies that I don't feel bad that I missed them in the theater when I finally do catch them at home, if I did miss them. So for us, the movies that we go see are movies that it's a cultural experience for my family or my friends more than it is because I need to see the film itself on a big screen in a big theater. And, you know, like, for the example, Star Wars for my family, that's an opening night dress up. Like, we go all out, cannot wait for this December for that. And the same thing, you know, we tend to catch Marvel movies very quickly. Cause that's, again, it's just something that my kids or soon to be teenagers that we all love doing it together. They love, it's something I can share with them. So we're going to go do that. But is the movie that much different? I don't know. I'd say that for a lot of them, maybe not.
I guess, like, I can think, even as you're saying them, Jason, like The Revenant, or Mikey, you said Gravity. I think of, I saw some critics who said on Twitter this week that they were on airplanes and the movie Silence was an option on the airplane to watch. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, what a terrible format to watch the movie Silence.
Well, like, because sitting it's going to be edited if nothing else.
Yeah, just this tiny screen and crammed onto an airplane is... I think the environment matters. I think the form matters. I think that changes it. Are there films that would be different? I just watched Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, or whatever it's called, in 3D at the behest of some film critic friends. And it was awesome. And it was silly and it's stupid and it's not like the best film in terms of plot or characterization, but it is the kind of movie, or like an Avatar, that if you watch it in 3D in a theater, I think it changes the experience of what that entails. Are there probably like romantic comedies, and maybe it has to do with genre. Honestly, a horror movie is more scary in a theater to me than it is in my living room. You know, action films are more thrilling. Doctor Strange, when I watched that in 3D, was way more interesting than when I watched it on Netflix, because of the visuals and what mm-hmm. the theater can do. And maybe it has to do with my mindset, too, of getting out of my house. And it's one of the only places that I don't check my phone.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
I'm trying to stay focused on something where sitting on my couch, I'm just so easily distracted. You know, if I'm hungry, I could just get up and go to my kitchen, or I have kids walk in every now and then, or I have to pause things, or I don't know. There's something about it's to maybe make an uneven religious parallel. If I'm praying just wherever I'm at versus if I go to a monastery to pray, or I go out to a particular place or location to devote time to prayer, I imagine my prayer life is different in those two places.
Mm-hmm.
And even if one, it's not necessarily better or worse than the other, but it does change something when I have the discipline to set time aside and to go to a new environment to make that happen, that I think I'm more open and aware of what is being offered, and I'm able to receive that. So it's like, I don't know, I don't have to go to art galleries. I can just look up cool paintings like the Mona Lisa on the internet. And I don't need to, you know, I don't need to listen to bands live because I can just listen to them on Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, if I have that mindset, I mean, those are all true, but I do think there's something different. Whether it's better or worse, I suppose, is dependent upon the audience and what they're willing to pay and the time and energy given. But it's still something where I don't think you can make a one-to-one connection of, like, watching this movie, whatever it is, even if it's just a romantic comedy. I don't know why I'm picking on that genre, but I am, in my living room versus watching it on a big screen theater. It's just different.
Mm-hmm. No, I think
take that into account.
I think that's one of the main things that I think about when I think of what am I getting from a theater that I'm not getting from my home entertainment, because, you know, TVs are cheaper than they've ever been. Surround sound systems are cheaper than they've ever been. Like, it is not difficult, if it is a priority to you at all, to find a way to afford like a fine home theater experience. So if you want to watch You've Got Mail, like, watching it at my house, I'm not going to miss anything that I would have missed seeing it in theater. All Tom Hanks and surround sound is going to be just as good at my house as it is in theater. But I've also noticed exactly what you're saying, that when I devote that time to go to the theater, I, you know, because of my own, you know, self-righteousness, I'm not going to be on my phone. I'm not going to be the guy texting. I'm going to do nothing but watch that movie. Whereas if I am at my house, I can easily be distracted for all the reasons that you said, you know, kids, food, phone, multitasking, trying to answer emails. Like, I do all those things when I watch movies from home, and I think it does diminish my experience. But what I'm curious about is, and this is something that I kind of ding Gravity for a couple years ago, is that when you make a movie that is basically a completely different experience in the theater, does that make your movie more of a gimmick than it does a good movie?
Hmm.
Because
go ahead. Well, I was, even with Gravity, so I watched it in theaters in IMAX, like the real IMAX,
mm-hmm.
in 3D, and it's still one of the most intense cinematic experiences I've ever had. And I left dizzy in a good way. And I bought it on Blu-ray. I took it home, and my wife and I watched it together.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't anywhere near as dizzying to me, but it was still thrilling. And Katie, my wife, couldn't take it. Like, she actually had to stop because it was so intense for her. And I was kind of like, man, I'm glad we didn't go see it together with the IMAX theater, because that, you know, you might have had, I don't know, a seizure or something. Like, mm-hmm. we would have had to go, and those are expensive tickets to bail on. I've watched it now at least two other times, just on Blu-ray. And there are things about that film that I have picked up on since. And I wonder, because I'll probably buy Dunkirk as well, and watch it at home. I imagine there will be things that I catch that Christopher Nolan was doing that I didn't catch that first time around. But that first time seeing it in theaters on 70mm was significant. So again, is it the same? I don't think so. But I don't think it's a gimmick. I think 3D, especially like post production 3D, where it's not even necessarily intended to be 3D, but they just add it so you can add $4 or $5 to the ticket. Yeah. And that kind of stuff, that's a gimmick, and that doesn't need to happen. And I rarely watch movies in 3D unless they're intended to be that way, like Valerian was, or like Gravity was. And Nolan didn't do that with Dunkirk. I mean, if you want to make an immersive experience, you could have done IMAX 3D and all that, but he didn't do that. And I think that's intentional, because that does feel a bit more gimmicky to me. So all that to say, I don't think it's a gimmick. I think it can be, and I do think it changes again depending on your experience with your home theater system. If it's not as good as others, like I don't have surround sound at my house. I don't have anything like that. I just have one big TV that is situated right in the middle of my house with lots of distractions. So I make the most of that that environment. But it's the film itself, I think, can stand on its own merits if it's a good film. It doesn't have to just be a gimmick. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think the same. I think that's it. You make a good point at the end there, Joel, of like movies, the experience changes, but that's not necessarily a bad thing either. That, like you said, watching Gravity at home, it you lose maybe some of the immersive side of it. And I think Dunkirk might be the same. Like, even if I watched it on the big screen with my surround sound and all that, it's probably not going to feel exactly the same, because, you know, I can't get it that loud and that immersive. But there will be other aspects of the movie that will come out in seeing it that way, you know, and watching it over time. But I think the main thing about the theater experience is that a lot of movies don't necessarily change between the two. But it's not about the movie as much as it is the cultural experience. You know, I've been a movie nerd about nerdy movies for a very long time, and I always tell people, like, the whole point isn't to be weird, or it's to go and just do something fun with friends and to make new friends. You know, I talk about the Star Wars thing. I've stood in line and gone to opening night of a Star Wars movie since 1999, when I was old enough to do it on my own. I've seen all of them in the theater multiple times, all the way back to when I was a little kid. But for me, like, that experience is more than the sum of the movie itself. You know, as much as Phantom Menace is not a good movie, I would never take away the experience I had with my friends at the time to do that. I have friends now because I met them at movie theaters, not randomly, but because another friend I had brought a friend. And hey, we both love movies. There's no reason not to be friends. Like, those kind of, the relationship building, the cultural experience of it, and then to be immersed in something like Dunkirk is great. Even if I can't ever recreate that experience again later, it's not necessarily going to, I don't think, take away from the movie in the long haul.
I have a Christopher Nolan related anecdote to this as well, where his last film, Interstellar, I watched that on IMAX, and I left that thinking that was visually impressive, but man, that was long and there's so much exposition, and I was pretty disappointed. It was pretty low on the film when it first came out. Mm-hmm. And then I watched it again, I think when it actually came out on Netflix, on my TV at home. And I think when I first watched it in theaters, I was so focused on the spectacular visuals and the soundtrack and all those things that I had missed the significance of what the story was about. And so when I watched it the second time at home, I caught on to what was going on in the story itself far greater than when I had seen it in theaters. And I was weeping on my couch when Matthew McConaughey's Cooper gets the messages from his daughter you know, and all the time that he's lost and missed. I had missed that the first time, and I caught that the second time on Netflix. So there's something to be said about that, and particularly for a Christopher Nolan film. I do wonder if there's going to be... I've heard the critique about Dunkirk that it's emotionally difficult to find an emotional center to it, or difficult to connect to a character on a deeper level, and that it's just this big, loud, immersive experience, but there's no personalized connection. And I wonder if people who watch the film at home later are going to have that experience of connecting to the characters. I didn't have that experience. I felt like I was, it was very emotional for me, and I did connect with Mark Rylance's character, Tom Hardy's character, Kenneth Branagh's character, whatever their names are, if they even have names. I connected with them and was moved by them. But I do think I caught something in Interstellar the second time on a smaller scale. And so there has to be something about that that's significant, that the form changed and so did my emotional reaction. And there's good and bad to that, but there's a connection there with Interstellar.
Well, I'm wondering if that's so. If like artist intent is kind of what I'm getting at in my train of thought right now, which is kind of derailing quickly. The if you get something, or if someone makes a movie specifically for the theater, specifically for 70mm IMAX, and you have an experience in that setting, but then you have a different experience, positive or negative, in a different setting. Did the filmmaker, like, either, I mean, I don't want to be too harsh, but did they fail? Or did they do something that you're maybe taking away something the artist didn't intend? And is that okay? And I ask that because, like, see, I see Dunkirk as an immersive experience. You keep using this phrase. And it really was. Like, I didn't even get to see it in real IMAX. I didn't get to see it in IMAX. And it was still incredibly loud. So loud, in fact, that the lady who was taking our tickets, since we went and saw a super late showing, she was a little more chatty and had time to talk to us about it. She said they had to actually change the theater that it was in because it was so loud that it actually cracked one of the lights in one theater.
Wow.
So they had to like move it to a different screen. And we were like, oh, okay. Well, thanks for the warning first.
Oh, man.
But outside of that experience, I would be in that group of people who said that I didn't have like an emotional connection. I mean, the closest thing was to Tom Hardy's character, which I think would probably be one of the easiest to have an emotional connection to. But Mark Rylance, as much as I enjoy him, he was just a guy there giving stoic lines to me. Like people, when people died, I didn't really care. And so if it wasn't for this experience that I had, then I just don't feel like I'd be very interested in the movie at all. Like, to the point where if I'm not going to see it on a biggest screen as possible, as loud as possible, then I feel like I have very little interest in seeing it because the story itself, like I already know the story. Like I didn't take anything emotionally away when, like I said, when people died or when people lived, I was like, okay, cool. And I don't feel like it's because I'm heartless, because as I have started to express on the podcast, ever since I've had my son, almost everything makes me cry now. And Dunkirk wasn't close. And so I'm trying to find a way to reconcile those things, of what's okay. Like, why is it okay to be one way in the theater and a different way not in the theater? Because to me, it's like a movie like this is like going to see like a minor league baseball game. Like, no one's going to watch a minor league baseball game at home and enjoy themselves. Well, not no one. Many people, the vast majority of people are not going to watch a minor league baseball game at home on their TV and enjoy it. But you can have a lot of fun at a minor league baseball game in person. It's a completely different experience because of the community thing we talked about, the atmosphere, all that stuff. It was meant to be enjoyed with participation, almost.
I go back to, I think that, one, there's anytime that a person makes art and shares it, right, they have to allow other people to interpret it in ways that they did not intend, right? So mm-hmm. anytime we get out of a movie what the creator, even when we get out of a movie the exact opposite of what a creator wanted us to get out of it, which, you know, happens, mm-hmm. that's the risk the creator takes. And that's the, and we, you know, and I appreciate people who are able to do that and throw it out there. I think, you know, sometimes we find that, and this is why we talk, I mean, even real world, right? We're trying to show, you know, through this podcast and other writings, a lot of the folks at Real World do, is this idea that there's deeper meaning behind things, even though it's not there on the surface. And even though maybe the people who worked on it couldn't or wouldn't, you know, use language themselves to describe it that way, but it is there because it's human condition sort of issues. So I think that, yeah, he created a very immersive experience, and you're sucked into that watching the movie there, and you almost don't have time. I kind of understand what you mean there, Mike. You almost don't have time to care, because I just felt like, it's like some of the scenes of drowning and stuff, they're just so horrifying, and you feel like you're in it, and you're just like, I just want to take a breath afterwards. And it's not until later you realize, well, that not everyone made it out of that, right? Like, mm-hmm. just surviving. And I almost feel like that may have been part of the reason it's done the way it is. But by reflecting on it and then watching it a second time, I was able to see some of those things, even though it was still in the big screen, I was able to see some of those things a little clearer the second time watching the movie. And to pay more attention to the facial expressions and to what the underlying, you know, this movie for me, there's a lot of, like, if you want to go in with black and white morality, you're going to have a really hard time with this movie, I think, yeah. because, you know, mm-hmm. you see people who do things like save a man who's on a stretcher dying on a beach, but they're kind of only doing it because they think it's going to get them on a boat sooner, right? Like, that's what people do. Seeing a young man watch his friend, this Mark Rylance's son, watch his friend get knocked down by a man who's suffering from shell shock, and eventually his friend dies, and yet he has to, the son has to forgive this man for killing his friend, or at least not add pain to this man. Like, there's some deep emotional things in there that, yeah, in the moment, when I was watching it the first time, it's all happening so fast that it didn't register. But the second time through, some of these things started to hit a little harder for me.
Yeah. So I guess to move on from that a little bit, but not to completely away from it, is that you're describing a lot of things that were, that Dunkirk specifically does that probably actually sets it apart from other war movies. And this is something that we were talking about right at the beginning of the show, and then I wanted to circle around back to it. So what is it that Dunkirk tells us about war? As best you can tell, what is it that we should be taking away from a movie like Dunkirk with the idea of war in mind that might... Because I think we'd all say that it's different than most of the war films we've seen. So how is it different? What is it trying to instill in us?
I think from my perspective, it is a war film, but it's also an adventure film or a rescue film, right? It's mm-hmm. about this huge rescue operation, and the British are doing much less fighting and more just trying to survive, you know? So it's just like a natural disaster survival film, but you're trying to survive against other human beings with weapons and guns and bombs, rather than a tornado or an earthquake. So I think that sets it apart. I think also the whole idea of the Dunkirk spirit and the solidarity of the British people and what the little ships did, you know, all these civilians going over to with this kind of steely resolve. But
yeah,
we're just going to get a cup of tea. We're going to get on our boat. And we're going to go for it. And Mark Rylance, I think, embodies that, you know, this, we're going to do this. And so there's this sense of courage, but it's very understated, you know, like what Tom Hardy's character does and how heroic it is, you know, there's not this, like, he's just kind of this quiet, steely eyed, I'm just going to do what I have to do kind of thing. And so that idea of resolving to do the right thing, even when it's difficult, I think is significant. And the solidarity of people with that Dunkirk spirit in the midst of adversity, and just being, I think I called it in my review, a non-anxious presence in the midst of what feels like despair, you know, just having a genuine sense of hope and then pushing through with proactive action. I think, at least for me, in our current political and cultural climate where there's just so much up and down and divisiveness and deceit, the idea of quiet, dutiful service and compassion for others, even when they don't necessarily deserve it, like with Cillian Murphy's character, who is shown mercy despite being a person who has killed another person in a fairly unnecessary act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those moments of mercy and compassion and courage were meaningful to me. They were powerful to me. And I was weeping for a good chunk of the film, if I'm honest. And I don't know if it's just because it was so intense in terms of the war sequences that, you know, like the battles and gunfire and drowning. I have a huge fear of drowning. And so that was maybe I'm just weeping in my seat being like, oh gosh, this is happening. And I don't know, maybe it was too immersive in that sense. But I think a lot of it had to do with the goodness of people in the midst of such badness, such a terrible situation that seems impossible. And then when those ships arrive and Tom Hardy's plane flies over, you know, and saves the day, it's just good news. And experiencing good news in a political climate of predominantly bad news felt like a breath of fresh air to me.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say the difference, not only what does this movie kind of have us take away about war in general and how that's different, but many people have talked about the difference between this as a British war movie versus mm-hmm. most of the war movies that we, especially in America, get, like very America-centric, patriotic war movies, and how those are different. But I am interested in kind of what you took away from it too, Jason.
What? I think, you know, I think if you wanted this to be a pro-war movie, you could find things in there. I think you'd be a little harder pressed if you wanted to say this was an anti-war film, like trying to say that, you know, all war is bad. But I don't, it's definitely not some of the more classic American style of, you know, it's ultimate patriotism and ultimate goodness comes in winning the war. This is really much more about coming together as a community to survive. And so I feel like, and because of that, it doesn't feel like a war movie in terms of genre. It feels like a movie about war, but it doesn't feel like war movie genre to me in a lot of those ways, because I think it's using war to make you feel it. And so if you feel all that, I don't see how you could come away from this going, man, I want to sign up to join.
Yeah.
You know, after watching that movie, I think one reviewer said that. And I guess if you liked planes and you saw what Hardy did and you're willing to sacrifice yourself for your greater man, maybe you'd sign up for the Air Force. But
yeah.
I can't see that I'd be wanting to storm beaches after watching this movie. You know, it's just, but at the same time, I get that sense of, if I was going to make an argument for when maybe you have to fight, it might be making that argument. Like, yeah, war sucks. It's terrible. but I did get the sense that there can be a noble aspect to it. If we go back to what we started with discussing what just war is. So I wonder if that's something Nolan is trying, or it's just something I was taking away from it personally. Cause you know, like I said, I kind of waffle back and forth about is, can you be that when you go to war?
Maybe it was a very long anti-infantry movie and actually like one of those like RAF promo kind of, it's just a really long commercial for the RAF. So people joining the Royal Air Force just spikes incredibly after this movie.
To fly
those Spitfires.
Yeah. I'm going to go back and fly Spitfires now. It'd be like Iron Eagle when they were playing all the slow planes and the fast, because everyone's seen Iron Eagle. Because nope. Anyway, it's like when you stop mid metaphor or whatever, or mid analogy, because you realize no one has seen it. I do want to start to kind of wind us down a little bit by talking about, because I think we're gonna hit on a couple other things that I'd like to talk about while we do this, and that's it's kind of running through our come on moments and our favorite moments. And I would be interested to say, because I know both you guys really like this film a lot, if there were things that did bother you about this film, like I said, because I know I have a couple things, but like Jason, was there anything that made you kind of say come on, or that you didn't like about the film?
I have trouble pointing out what it was, because again, for me, we talked a little bit recently, you and I, just this idea that I'm trying to figure out what the director and the writer, right? What are they trying to tell me? So when I felt uncomfortable, was that because that's what they wanted me to feel, or is that because I felt a dissonance in the storytelling? I haven't been able to really say there.
I'm wondering if Jason's headset fell off.
It's still there.
Hold on, we'll let him.
I can share what I was thinking. I don't have too many things that I had problems with when it came to Dunkirk, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I have been trying to think through what are the things that did bother me. And I think the only things, there are two, and they're pretty common within Nolan's filmography. And that's, first of all, he seems to consciously avoid religious or spiritual language or ideas in his films. And so they end up being very materialist. The idea that all of these British soldiers are going through this experience and not one of them is praying or mentions religious ideas or, you know, even mm-hmm. talking about heaven or hell. It seems a bit unrealistic to me.
Maybe that's just the British way.
Be a part of it. Well, there's a huge British history of religion and, you know, being Anglican and what the Church of England is all about. You know, there's all sorts of stuff there, or if they're Catholic or whatever. The idea of avoiding that purposefully, and I don't know that I would fault Nolan for it necessarily, but it does seem like he goes out of his way to de-emphasize spirituality. And it did talk about the opening sequence that they needed hope for a miracle, which is religious language. But that is probably more to the what's become known as the miracle at Dunkirk. You know, that it's these little ships, they came, they saved everybody, and all these people were saved.
Mm-hmm.
To not use religious language regarding those things, it feels like you're trying not to. At least in my opinion, and maybe that's just where I'm coming from as a pastor theologian. The second thing that bothers me is Nolan's repeated idea of a noble lie. The idea that if you lie to people and give them kind of a false reality that's good and better than the negative truth, that's okay or maybe even laudable or praiseworthy. And so it doesn't happen as significantly in this film as it does in his other movies, where people lie all the time for the greater good or I can think of specific examples in Memento and in the end of The Dark Knight,
mm-hmm.
You know, in Interstellar, that's we're going out there on this crazy mission, but it's actually, we had to lie to everybody that there really isn't a mission. And those, that idea that people can't handle the truth, or that hiding the truth is better for people, bothers me. And what happens with Cillian Murphy's character, where the question is raised, did he kill the boy? And it's not like huge, but they're just, the fact that it's not acknowledged, or he doesn't have to deal with that, it's hidden from him.
Mm-hmm.
Does feel a little bit like a, like that noble eye kind of creeping in again. So it's just a common motif that he brings into his movies that I'm uncomfortable with, and yet I still like his movies. So I don't know what that says about me and my own inconsistencies.
Mm. Well, we won't tell you if we have a problem with your inconsistencies.
Thank you. Yeah, just lie to me.
That's right.
And let me know that everything's okay.
Yeah. We still like you, Joel. Sure we do. You have
do
friends.
You though? I hope you do.
Well, so I feel like I've had this conversation many times on Facebook, and it has gone many ways. And it's very interesting to me that the more creative control that Christopher Nolan has over one of his films, I've found the less that I like it. So basically, there's just been like a small downward line graph since his first film. I call it this like the Stephen Moffat, where someone has really great ideas and they're thinking outside the box and they're thinking of telling stories in a way that no one has ever done. But unless someone comes along and kind of like helps channel that imagination, that it just is free flowing and hard to follow, because they're doing almost too much. And that's how I feel about Christopher Nolan. I thought Interstellar was the most Christopher Nolan-y film that I'd seen until I saw Dunkirk. Because everything that annoyed me about Interstellar, I feel like he just did that times 10 in Dunkirk. I feel like,
how so? Like, what are those elements that you would consider Nolan-y?
So I feel like he loves the idea of, I think he loves ideas more than he likes people. And so people tend to be placeholders for emotions or ideas in his film. People walk around and they have conversations that they would never really have in real life. Like I said, this is really bad in Interstellar. You know, like every conversation is super important. And is, like I said, people just don't talk like they're actual human beings. But that goes to that exposition piece that we saw in Interstellar. And I know there's not a lot of dialogue in Dunkirk, but what dialogue we do get is functional at best. That's why we're not connecting with any of the characters, because, again, I feel like the characters are placeholders for ideas, whether that's perseverance or hope, duty, community, even salvation or redemption. Like, I feel like his characters end up being ideas more than they are actual human beings that also partake in this idea. And that's very hard for me, because, like I said, it leaves me cold. Like, there was not really almost like anybody in Interstellar I connected with. There was no one really I connected with, and like, or I didn't connect near as much as I wanted to with any of the characters in Inception. But it was a cool idea. Same thing when you go, I think the Batman trilogy that he did is the epitome of this, because Batman Begins, like, he still wasn't, you know, Christopher Nolan. He's still making films with other people. He still has other producers, and there are some constraints on his really neat and cool ideas of being a visionary and technical kind of director that is really pushing the envelope and making film better as a whole because of how he's raising the bar. But by the time you get to The Dark Knight Rises, you just have like an incoherent mess full of a whole bunch of incomplete ideas and characters that are confusing and spend more time kind of monologuing about things that don't make sense and there's some great action. And again, technically it's fun to watch, but it's, like I said, it's more of a mess. And so Dunkirk, again, technically is great, even though I do have problems with his sound mixing as well. I feel like Christopher Nolan's like the sound guy at church who doesn't actually know how to mix. So he just keeps turning everything up until it's all like muffled and incoherent. And he's like, yeah, it's louder, so it's better. I think I saw a tweet in one of the articles that said Nolan is to terrible sound mixing what J.J. Abrams is to lens flares. Like, you just know you're going to get it now. And part of that I can write off as immersive, because like I said, it was immersive, but at some point it just doesn't do it for me personally. These are all things that annoyed me about Dunkirk, despite the fact that I enjoyed the experience. I really hesitate to think that I would enjoy the experience as much if I saw it like on my TV at home. I hope it would be like what you're describing, Joel, where I watch it and outside of that, I'm able to focus more on the actual characters themselves and maybe I would pick up something that I missed. But I was talking to Jason, I think before the show, that because I see most of his characters as placeholders for something else besides that character, like I don't even have any idea who was who most of the film with the infantry people. To the point where I thought at the end of the film, who we'll call Tommy, even though he's never called Tommy, but he's credited as Tommy. I thought Tommy and his French friend were the ones on the train at the end because I it's hard to distinguish for me. And Jason's like, it wasn't. It was some other guy. And I'm like, well, there's another guy? How did I miss this? Oh, because I didn't care about the characters.
It was the Harry Styles character was the one who lived, the one who wanted the French guy dead. He survives and is with Tommy, and the Frenchman, I believe, drowns when the boat fills with water. He's the one who doesn't get out. The one they tried to push out first is the one who ends up not being able to get out at all.
Because he's stayed behind to hold, actually to save the others, essentially, because he's trying to plug holes.
So it's like I said, it was hard for me to follow. And I'd hope I wouldn't miss that on a second viewing, maybe at my house where I'm not distracted by sound or size.
So I've heard that. I want to ask you a question kind of related to this, because it came up on the Real World Theology page as well. The question of, did anybody get the structure, you know, the timing structure going into it? Did you follow that, or was that totally confusing? You know, the way that time was different for each of those three different locations. And I was surprised at how many people didn't understand it going into the film and didn't really seem to get it even afterwards until they read a review or it was explained to them. And so even with the characters, I get that there was people who were like, we didn't know who Harry Styles was or which character was which. Are those things that are Nolan's? Should the weight of the critique be on Nolan's shoulders for not making that clear to audiences? Or are audiences, do they need to catch up onto those things? Or does my question make sense? Like, is that Nolan's fault that the characters didn't connect with you? Or is that your lack of connection with them in that particular viewing because you didn't track with where characters were at? Does that make sense?
No, it does. And I think this is something that I think I could argue either way, but I would look to what is usually leveled against like action films. So if we're going to knock Michael Bay for making incoherent Transformers films where we can't, one that are bad for many things, but one of those main critiques is that when action is happening, you can't actually follow the action. You can't tell what characters where and why and how and when. So if we're going to knock him for that, then I think we should be able to knock Christopher Nolan for the same thing. If I'm not really sure what's going on and I can't tell, like, you're not giving me enough time with a character, or you're not setting a character apart enough that I can't tell what's going on. Or maybe it's because all white people look the same to me, and maybe that's my problem. But like, you know,
you're just racist.
I am. I don't like white people. So like, I think if we can criticize one filmmaker about it, then we can criticize another.
Totally.
So if you're, I think it's their job, to tell a story that you can follow. And I think I would have, I don't really think that, I think the time thing was actually creative. I think that's another example, of how Christopher Nolan is raising the bar, in some levels. I think he's great technically. I just think he's not a very good storyteller. I think maybe his brother might be a good storyteller, because it seems like whenever he gets him heavily involved, they usually tell a story I'm interested in. Cool. But I think that technically Christopher Nolan is pushing the bar so far past where it usually is, that he's almost like the new James Cameron. Like he's doing things that people didn't think that you could do on film. And I think that's awesome, because I'm sitting there and this is my bridge to probably favorite moments, but like all the stuff, like I've seen so many war movies. I have so many war movies. I used to fake being sick, so I could stay home on school days when they were having like Operation TNT. So I could watch, so I could watch old war movies all day. And I have never been so on the edge of my seat or interested in, air to air combat than I was when I was watching, Dunkirk. I thought that was amazing. And I was like, how did he take something so simple and make it so compelling? That's great. And I wish more people would, kind of learn from that. But the time thing didn't work. The time thing didn't bother me. I think the time thing was great. Super creative. That's stuff we've seen in many of his other films. And to be fair, it did take me a couple days to see Dunkirk. So I was trying to avoid spoilers as much as possible, as much as you can avoid spoilers about a historical event that you know what happens. And I think one of the first things, like in the real world discussion, theology discussion group, was someone saying, "Hey, you know, did anyone like notice this blank thing?" And when I was scrolling through, you know, just because when you try not to look at something, you kind of see it anyway. And one of the first comments was like, "Yeah, I totally understood that it was like three different times," or something like that. So I had that, I had that going in. So I actually really like the fact that, like, when you're with Mark Rylance's, I'm basically doing all my favorite moments now. Well, like when you're with Mark Rylance and those guys on the boat, like you see the Spitfires fly over, or when you see the Spitfires fly over, you realize you're already past where you were on the boat. Like noticing those things or seeing the boat in the background and being like, that's the same boat, you know, things like that. It actually made it better, but ultimately, to fully bridge between come on moments and, like I said, the reason that Nolan isn't one of my favorite directors anymore is, but still having respect for it, is I love what J.R. Forrester said in his review haiku, which is kind of silly to say because it's such a small thing, but he pointed out that he's like, you don't connect with the characters, but with the struggle. And I can totally agree with that. Like, while I have all my issues with not being able to connect to characters, usually characters are the reason that I want to watch a movie over and over and over again. That's why I'll watch Saving Private Ryan over and over and over again. I care about almost all those characters. But despite that, I still, much like you guys, you know, edge of your seat, very tense, watching other people in the theater kind of react to it, I felt like I was part of the struggle. And I'm okay with that. And I'm like I said, I'm okay with that. It's like I said, I feel like by having any kind of negative feelings about this film, I feel like people think I hated this film. And I didn't. it's probably not going to make my top 10 at the end of the year for various reasons.
That's fair.
But I think it might make both of y'all's. And I'm kind of curious what it did. I'm sure we've talked a little bit about it, but like, what were your favorite moments? Like, why is this movie setting itself apart? Jason.
Yeah.
Random, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's what's the thing about the movie is in some movies you go, oh, my favorite part was this moment because I had the yeah moment.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this one, I get drawn, the moments that come out to me are more those moments where I was dumbfounded with like almost dread or just deep sadness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a line I, again, having seen it twice, I think helped me when Tommy and the rest of the infantrymen are in the Dutch boat and they're trying to get rid of the Frenchmen because they think that they're too heavy. There's a line that where Tommy's saying, guys, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But he eventually admits, I'll go along with it, but it's still wrong, because he wants to survive that badly. And like, those are those little character moments where they were so just sad to me that they stuck with me. And those are the ones that I just have had to chew on that, since, you know, it's been in the back of my mind the whole time. So it's not a, wow, I love this moment. It's a moment that I can't get away from.
Yeah.
For those different reasons.
Mm. Yeah. What about you, Joel?
It's hard to describe specific moments in Dunkirk. I think for what Jason's talking about too, where it's this entire experience. And even what you said, Mikey, about JR's haiku, it is all about struggle. And so the whole thing kind of is this one, you have to take it as a whole, and pulling little bits and pieces out of it, it kind of misses out on the whole, is how I felt about it. Like, it's just this overarching emotional experience. That's where, like, even not being able to connect with specific characters or specific moments, sometimes emotionally, I felt like the whole thing was emotion. The whole thing is about the experience itself. And so I don't even know if it's necessarily about story. I don't know if that's Nolan's intent here, is mm-hmm. to necessarily tell a story is to create an experience for people to experience that struggle, to put themselves in these soldiers' shoes in those boats. But a couple scenes that stood out to me, I think Tom Hardy's performance is remarkable for how little, like, how confined he is with what he has to work with. He's literally like a head covered in all this gear, and it's just his eyes. And it's kind of like his performance in Locke, where he was in the car, but he can't talk. You know, you can barely understand what he's saying, and he doesn't really talk that much. And the scene where he decides to turn his plane around when he recognizes he doesn't have enough fuel, but there's a bomber behind and it's going to hit that ship and those boats. And just the look on his face and the expression that he has in his eyes communicates that decision-making process entirely without having to say anything. I thought that was remarkable and moving again, like the decision that he's making internally, that I know that I'm probably going to die if I do this. But I have to, because it's the right thing to do. And nobody necessarily is going to know. Like, nobody would fault him for flying back, you know, to get more fuel or to go back to do what he was supposed to do. But the fact that he turns around and does what he does is pretty significant to me. And then again, when the little boats showed up, I just about lost it. Like, when it's like, this is home, and Kenneth Branagh's performance there, and he's all excited, and it's one of the most hopeful moments of the entire film. I thought that was, after all the despair and the pain and the struggle that people have gone through, this moment of catharsis of, okay, home has shown up on our doorstep at this beach, and now we can, now we're saved, you know, salvation is here. I think that particular moment was remarkable as well. But I mean, like you said, Mikey, like all the technical aspects of this, I think the sound structure, I don't know, I think he's doing that more intentionally than just turning everything up really loud. Even the muffled voices and the I think he's very particular about, he seems almost overly perfectionistic and detailed in what he's choosing to do. So I don't think that that's an accident, even going back to Bane and his silly voice. Whether we liked it or not, I don't know, and whether it works or not, but I don't think it was an accident on Nolan's part or, you know, him being inept in his sound mixing. And I, again, love the narrative structure with the different time frames and perspective. It's my favorite film of the year so far, which surprised me. I almost wish it wasn't, because it feels like being a stereotypical Nolan fanboy, which I am not. But I do appreciate what he does with his films. And I, for some reason, and maybe I'm overly cerebral and lack ideas more than I like people. I don't know. I don't know what that says about me as a pastor. But maybe that's why I'm becoming an academic and a theologian, is that I like the ideas that he raises, but they're still very humane, human ideas, things that we deal with, questions of hope and struggle and despair and war and death. And I think he corrects a lot of the things that he's done poorly in the past, like the fact that it's under 2 hours, the fact that there's not as much exposition. In my review, I said it's the loudest film he's ever made and the quietest film he's ever made, because there's so little dialogue and it's all about just facial expressions and action here. So I don't know. Those are all my favorite things. I could keep going on, but I'll stop.
Yeah. In terms of ranking this, yeah, it's going to be high on my list this year. It doesn't quite eclipse Logan for me. Usually when I do a top 10 list, it's about what movie just struck me. Usually it's for some reason I just identified with the movie in some way, and Logan has been that. But that's where it's been hard. I don't want to make this just like glowing praise Nolan fanboy for 2 hours. I've been trying to think about things from a different perspective as well. I agree with you. The things that some of the actors do in this, that, and that's what's nice with, you know, to be able to be in Nolan's shoes, to be able to get Tom Hardy and Rylance and Kenneth Branagh all in the same film and never ever actually in the same place at the same time, so they can carry their scenes. Like I think it adds that much to the movie, and it keeps that power going. I rate it pretty highly as well. And I think it's one of the few movies this year I've gotten to see twice, and it stood up the second time. So I think it's going to stand up for me over time as well. Sometimes I'll, you know, see a movie and be like, oh, greatest thing ever. And then the second showing, you're like, oh, wait, starting to see the flaws. And I'm sure that there are flaws in this movie. But again, something I was talking to Mikey about before the show was this idea that this year I've seen a lot more movies than I normally see, and I've been trying to see them in the theater. But I've been seeing it more from an aspect of, what do I think this director or this creator is trying to tell me? And let me just be along for the ride of that. And then later when I see him again, I'll start to look at it more from a different eye. But, you know, we go back to the idea of trying to compare it to a Michael Bay film. Well, I watch Michael Bay films for a different reason. So when they're completely incoherent and I can't tell what's going on in the action scenes, I'm not enjoying them. But with something like this, I kind of expected it to be that, because again, we talked about the immersive nature of the film.
Yeah, and I don't know that those action scenes are as incoherent as like maybe that critique is being made, because I followed along pretty well even when I wasn't like entirely sure who was going to survive a particular situation or how it was going to play out. One confusing aspect for me actually is when Cillian Murphy's character shows up in a boat in the for the guys on the beach, and I was trying to figure out the timeline of that, like how many days have actually passed here, or what is that saying that he's in both of those sequences, and I still haven't been able to necessarily connect that, and maybe a second viewing would open my eyes more to that. Even the casting choices of casting relatively no-name actors, apart from Harry Styles, who most people in America probably can't identify still, or at least, unless you're a teenage girl, maybe. Like, they kind of all blend together, and I think that's very purposeful. That this is these are just people, and it all does kind of blur together in war. Time blurs together. It's hard to keep track of who is who and who's going where and how long time has actually passed. I think that's all very intentional. It's intentionally confusing so that audiences are wondering along with the characters just what exactly is happening. And so even like not necessarily knowing their names, I was okay with that because sometimes in a situation like that where somebody like picks up a stretcher behind you and you're running along a beach and you're trying to muscle your way through, like you don't know names, you're just kind of going with it. Mm-hmm. So it's very action oriented in that sense rather than character or story. It's just kind of the mise-en-scene and you embrace it or receive it. And I think that's what you're talking about, Jason, just receiving what the director is putting before you and trying to understand it from that perspective first and receive it first before being able to, you know, take it further and into the critical realm. I think that's important.
So, Joel, are you saying that based on what I'm hearing, you're saying that one of Christopher Nolan's intentions was for you to watch the film as a teenage girl so that you can keep track of what's going on?
That's pretty much, I think
That's the one takeaway I'm taking away from all of that.
I did cry a lot. And, you know, I did think Harry Styles had really nice hair. So I have to admit, this is bringing my teenage girl out a little bit. Not that all teenage girls cry a lot or think Harry Styles is cute. But I would say a fair amount do.
Yeah, but
and
odds.
I'm a youth pastor. I can say these things.
It's okay. I've been given permission.
Well, totally.
Well, like I said, so that's kind of what I figured would happen. I figured if we went through kind of the down moments and the up moments, we would actually hit on a whole bunch of things that we haven't been able to specifically talk about the movie, and I think we did that. So, you know, great success. Again, please don't send me all your hate mail because I don't think Christopher Nolan is my favorite director. But you can send all your happy mail to Jason or Joel because they are big fans. So if you'd like to send stuff to them, I would love to give them just a little space here at the end of the show to let you know how you can send them stuff. So, Joel, how can people follow you or send you happy mail? Because we don't send hate mail.
Yeah. You can check out my website. It's CineMayward, CineMayward.com. Or follow me on Twitter, @ Joel Mayward. And those are probably the two best ways to get a hold of me and see what I'm up to.
Awesome. And Jason, how can people follow you or interact with you on the interwebs?
Yeah, fastest way to find me would be my website, rindaria.com, RYNDARIA.com, just where I put random musings and other things about culture and either writing or movies, or @ Rindaria on Twitter.
Nice. And I will make sure to have all those things in the show notes over at realworldtheology.com because, as I say every episode, great conversations happen because we have great guests, and I want you to be able to continue to interact with them. One way that you can do that is by joining our Real World Theology Facebook discussion group, where basically, I'd say 90% of anyone who's ever been involved with the podcast resides there and is excited to interact with listeners and each other, just continuing these conversations because even though this podcast tends to skew long, it's still not enough to talk about some of these films. And based on the fact that there's already been like 3 or 4 Dunkirk threads, I'm sure that there's plenty more to talk about. So you can find that at Facebook. You can, again, go to realworldtheology.com and find show notes and other items for this. You can follow me on Twitter @ Physification. And if you'd like to support the show, again, you can go to realworldtheology.com/support and see all the various ways we have that you can support this show and website. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the show and however, whatever way, whatever podcast app, whatever podcast, whatever, you get your podcast, whether it be iTunes or whatever, Stitcher, anything. Heck, if you just download it from the site, you can get us anywhere. Rate and review the show. It helps us a ton. And we will continue to do our best to continue to make 5-star content for you to rate 5 stars and 5 stars and 5 stars. I just wanted to make sure that we said that a lot. So it's always great to have Joel. It's always great to have Jason on the show. I've really enjoyed this conversation. And for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
There are definitely people here in the Portland, Oregon area who just, that's what they do. They wear kilts and it's cool, I guess. It's weird.
Gotta love Portland.
Yeah, we are weird.